Starts this morning. Let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Comfort ye my people, saith God, saith your God. Speak ye comfortable to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The voice said, Cry. And he said, What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever. O Zion, that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem, that bringeth good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, Behold your God. Behold, the Lord God will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lamb with his arms, and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out the heavens with the span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as but a small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. To whom, then, will ye liken God? Or what likeness will ye compare unto him? The workman melteth a graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold, and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning work to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grass, grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, that bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth. And he shall blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things, and bringeth out their hosts by number. He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might. For that he is strong in power, not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, My way is hid from the Lord, and my judgments is passed over from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might, he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint, be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that waiteth upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. We want to discuss a few things concerning Israel. When we hear the name Israel, it evokes many different thoughts for us. Israel, the man, introduces us to the patriarch who was the son of Isaac and called to be a prince with God. Israel, the nation, reminds us of the story of a chosen people concerning whom Paul wrote, "To whom pertaineth the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises, whose are the fathers, and of whom, as concerning the flesh, Christ came." And also Israel, the land, a place at the crossroads of continents, and which has been at the heart of God's purpose with mankind. If you truly understand that the God of Israel had and still has a concern for the affairs of this nation, who are the vehicle of his revelation as found in the scriptures. The land, though small by comparison to most countries, has a tremendous diversity and contrast of environments. 9 times in the Old Testament we find the term "from Dan unto Beersheba" used to describe the boundaries of the land settled by the children of Israel. That's only a distance of 140 miles. From the seacoast to the Jordan is about 50 miles. Yet from within this nation, even from within an area of 15 miles, the elevation goes from barren hills, 3,300 feet high, to 1,300 feet below sea level. Within an area of 10 miles, you can go from barren hills to lush tropical vegetation. Even within the sight of one another, you can go from snow-capped mountains to semi-tropical growth. When the children of Israel were to enter the land, Yahweh told them, "For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of waters, of fountains and depths that spring out of the valleys and the hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass." By the time we come to Ezekiel and his prophecy, Israel had become an international supplier of wheat, honey, oil, and balm. In Ezekiel 27, we read, "Judah and the land of Israel, they were thy merchants. They traded in thy market wheat of Minnith and Penag and honey and oil and balm." Minnith and Penag were places where wheat was exported. Israel was the only exporter of olive oil in those days. The main use for that oil, we know, was to provide light. Israel truly lit up the world, but failed to enlighten the world as God wanted them to do. Israel exists between two ancient centers of trade and power, the Nile and the Euphrates. 2 major trade routes went through the land, the Via Maris, which went along the Mediterranean coast, and the King's Highway, which was on the other side of the Jordan and is still used today. The land and its people had been known by several names. We first read of it in scriptures as the land of Canaan. Canaan was the grandson of Noah. And when Noah's children began to settle after the flood, we read in Genesis 10, "And Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, and the Hivites, and the Arkites, and the Sinites, and the Arvadites, and the Semarites, and the Hamathite. And afterwards were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad." These names help us to recognize the land area, for we find cities named after those such as Sidon. And there are towns today that still bear the names of the Arkites, and the Sinites, and the Hamathites. All this helps us to confirm the accuracy of the biblical record in Genesis. Like Israel, the name Canaan applied both to the land and the people. This chart gives us a timeline as to how long this people have been associated with this land. Just prior to Abraham coming into this land, the coastal plains had been invaded by the sea people, whom we know as the Philistines. Who owns the land is a point of great contention in the world today. The land came also to be known as the Promised Land. That title has reference to the covenant that Yahweh made with Abraham almost 4,000 years ago. In Hebrews 11, we read, "By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God." 430 years later, the people of Israel were reminded about the land of promise while slaves in Egypt. While the Passover was being instituted, Moses told the elders, "And it shall come to pass, when ye come to the land which the Lord will give you, according as he has promised, that ye shall keep this service." From this it came to also be known as the Promised Land. After the Babylonian captivity, the land was known as Judea. We come forward in time to the time of Christ, and we find in AD 70 and again in AD 135, the Romans tried to rid the land of all memories of Judea and the Jews. They renamed the land Palestina. And it's important to note that it was the Romans who named the land Palestina. And they changed the name of Jerusalem to Elea Capitolina. From that time forward until 1948, the name Palestine was used in all official documentation. But in May of 1948, David Ben-Gurion announced that the name of the newly formed state he was founding would be Israel, and its people would be Israelis. At the core of this land of Canaan, the Promised Land, the land of Israel, is the covenant that deity made with Abraham and his family, both natural and spiritual. This man was well chosen by God to establish a covenant that would bring redemption to a fallen race. When Abram made his journey to the land of Canaan, the land was settled by the sons of Shem, while the coast had been invaded by the Philistines. There were many independent cities, and each city had its own king. This chart shows seven aspects of the covenant made between Yahweh and Abraham and his descendants. It comes from Brother Collier's work, Israel, the Land and People of Destiny. And in it he comments, "None of these seven aspects of God's solemn covenant with Abraham was fulfilled in his day. His faith was such that nevertheless, he implicitly believed that they would all be fulfilled. It is true that his descendants have occupied the land from time to time, but never has it been securely theirs. He did not live to see the great nation, nor to see all families of the earth being blessed. While Abraham lived a long life, he never lived forever. Abraham's faith foresaw the complete fulfillment of all aspects of the divine covenant, a confidence that was shared by Isaac and Jacob. This was later to become known as the hope of Israel. Such was the character of this man that he was called the friend of God. His character was unique. His faith was tested many times. From his first test and being cut off from his past to the utmost trial and offering his only son to God in sacrifice. Abraham was very much alone in the world, even as his descendants would be a lonely people. There were many opportunities for Abraham to give in and to be assimilated into the world, but he resisted, as he did with the king of Sodom. Israel, though, would also be tempted to be assimilated as a way of escape from the fruits of their unfaithfulness. His name was changed from Abram, meaning the Father is exalted, to Abraham, meaning father of a multitude. The faith he manifested in the promises of God earned him the name the Father of the Faithful. This title was not limited to the Jews only, but is all-encompassing, as Paul describes in Romans chapter 4, and we're going to read from the Revised Standard. He received circumcision as a sign or seal of the righteousness which he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believe without being circumcised, and who thus have righteousness reckoned to them. And likewise, the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but also follow the example of the faith which our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. Abraham came to the land of promise as a stranger, not a conqueror. For the most part, he remained separate, not having much contact with the people in the land. The one thing he did share was a common faith in the one true God with the king priest of Salem. Thus, the land of Canaan was not entirely pagan in those days, nor were they without a representative of Yahweh. There was a light stand in the land for those who cared to see. We read in Genesis 12:1 that the Lord said unto Abram to go to the land he would show him. Arriving at Shechem, the Lord confirmed to Abraham in Genesis 12, verse 7, that unto thy seed will I give this land. So we understand that the promise of the land came first, then the promise of a people. Even with the promise given, Abraham dwelt as a stranger in the land. He had no place to bury his wife Sarah, so that he had to buy a field for 400 shekels of silver. Paul, commenting on this situation, writes, "By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city whose foundations and whose builder and maker is God." We read those earlier. The city which Abraham looked for was not one in the sky, but a divinely provided political occupation of the very same land that the Lord had promised him and had covenanted to him. The history of this land and its people are carefully chronicled in the Bible over a period of many centuries. This land has a special place in the purpose of deity. Seven times in the messages given by his prophets, deity calls this land my land. What is so special about this land? Is it its location, its history, its geography? It's the meeting point of the earth's land masses, and that's very significant. The land is central to three continents. It is in the intersection of Asia and Africa, and has been the cause of many violent disputes. It may be the most fought over land on the earth, but its true purpose will be a site for the proclamation of peace around the world. The land is unique in other ways. The vegetation of three continents meet in Israel. It's the eastern limit for the Mediterranean plants, the southern limit of European plants, and the northernmost extreme for several African plants. We've already discussed its geography, which is most unique. And we may not come to a full appreciation of Yahweh's choice of this land until his name is established in the mountains of Israel. The city of Jerusalem is also unique and special. And the next couple of charts go through the many conflicts that have been fought over Jerusalem by man. As the children of Israel approached the land, they were told that there was a place which the Lord would choose to place his name there. Joshua was able to overcome Adonai Zedek, the king of Jerusalem, but the city still remained in the hand of the Jebusites. The city was not taken until David had been king in Hebron for 7 years. It appears that the city of God's choice was not to be occupied until they had a king of divinely appointed line of Judah. David, a man after God's own heart, was another man of great faith, as was Abraham. That Jerusalem was chosen by God is made clear in the words of David in Psalm 132. "For the Lord hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it." From the time of David, Jerusalem has been the national and spiritual center for Israel. Ezekiel records, "Thus saith the Lord God, this Jerusalem I have set her in the center of the nations with countries round about her. Even when no Jew was allowed to live in the city because of the decree of Hadrian in AD 135, it has still been at the center of their thoughts and hopes. The people of Israel have twice been evicted from their homeland. Twice they've lost their independence. Twice the temple's been destroyed by pagan invaders. They forfeited their inheritance because they had repeatedly broken their part of the covenant. They were exiled from their land in bits and pieces to be scattered among many nations, some as slaves, but mostly as refugees seeking asylum. By all standards, these calamities would have been the end of the identity of Israel as a nation. But it's not been the end for a very good reason. The nations that dispossessed them, that enslaved them, that spoiled them, that slew them, that persecuted them, have all disappeared. They are all part of history now. But Israel is still now identifiable, having continued despite their scatterings to all parts of the earth. They were and are still the people of God's covenant with Abraham. The covenant has not been broken or forgotten, but is waiting fulfillment in all its details promised so long ago. The covenant can be fulfilled by no other than the Son of Abraham, whom Yahweh provided in due course, even our Lord Jesus the Messiah. With that said, we want to review a few current events relating to what's going on in Israel today. Because many things that we read of and hear in the news are quite contrary to the actual facts of what has happened. We remember this chart from Brother Mac's class concerning the push for peace in the Middle East. And here's just a few thoughts. After World War II, the United Nations proposed to establish two states in the region known as the Middle East, a Jewish state and an Arab one. The Jews accepted the UN's proposal and declared their independence in 1948. The Jewish state constituted only 1/6 of 1% of what was known as the Arab world. The Arab states, however, rejected the UN plan and since then have consistently waged war against Israel in the form of an all-out conventional war and wars of terrorism. In 1948, five Arab armies invaded Israel in an effort to eradicate it. The tiny nation of Israel overcame and conquered the invaders. The truth is that Israel has already returned most of the land that it captured during the 1967 war. Immediately after that war, Israel offered to return all of it in exchange for peaceful relations. Their offer was rejected. It wasn't until 1978 when the Camp David Accord was signed by Menachem Begin of Israel and Anwar Sadat of Egypt, that Egypt finally recognized the right of Israel to exist and relations were normalized between the two countries. Israel returned the Sinai Desert to Egypt, a territory three times the size of Israel. They returned 91% of the territory that they had captured in 1967. There are 21 Arab countries in the Middle East, and only one Jewish state. Israel is also the only democracy in the region. And I think that plays somewhat against Israel because their emphasis is that they are a democracy when they were founded as a theocracy. While Jews are not permitted to live in many Arab nations, Arabs that are born in Israel are granted full citizenship and have the right to vote in Israeli elections. Several Arabs have been duly elected to the Knesset. Arabs who live in Israel have more rights by their own admission, more freedoms, and a better lifestyle than most Arabs living in the Arab states. Frequent mention of UN Resolution 242 does not, in fact, require a complete withdrawal from the West Bank. And I didn't know that. As a legal scholar, Eugene Rostow stated, Resolution 242, which is Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs between 1966 and 1969, I helped produce, calls on the parties to make peace and allow Israel to administer the territories it occupied in 1967 until a just and lasting peace in the Middle East is achieved. When such a peace is made, Israel is required to withdraw its armed forces from territories it occupied during the Six-Day War, not from the territories, nor from all the territories, but only from some of the territories. In July of 2000, in an unprecedented gesture, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak offered almost all of the territories to Arafat at Camp David. Arafat refused, even to utter frustration of President Clinton. Clinton later is reported to have told Arafat, "You made me a failure," because Clinton wanted to have that Middle East peace agreement as his legacy. Claims that Israeli resettlement in the West Bank is the obstacle to peace are easily refuted when it's historically demonstrable that the Jews lived there for centuries before being massacred or driven out by invading Arabs in 1948 and 49. And contrary to common misconception, Israeli settlements are actually resettlements, that is, a return to the land historically belonging to Israel, which they have now come back to resettle. The statement is made, Israeli is occupying Palestinian land. Well, we've just looked at some of the charts there, and we see that Israel's been in the land over 3,000 years. So that's not a valid point. The Palestinians deserve a homeland. There has never been a land known as Palestine governed by Palestinian. There is no language known as Palestinian. There is no distinct Palestinian culture. Palestinians are Arabs, as are Jordanians, Syrians, Lebanese, and Iraqis, and so on. Therefore, to use the word to distinguish a group of Arabs who want to be known as the rightful heirs of the land is outrageous. It is interesting that when Mark Twain visited Israel in 1860, he noted that the land was desolate and with only a few shepherds living there. The Jews began to return to Israel in 1881. The Jews made the desert bloom again. Arabs began to come out to the area to get jobs. Only in 1967 did Arabs begin to claim they were the true Palestinians and that the land of Israel had always belonged to them. By contrast, the land. The Arabs control over 5 million square miles, yet there's only one Jewish state consisting of 8,000 square miles. Why haven't the Jordanians, the Syrians, or the Egyptians offered to give the Palestinians a homeland? These Arabs, who call themselves Palestinians, deserve a home. They may remain in Israel and abide there by their laws, living in peace with their neighbors. If they cannot live in peace in Israel, then they can move to an Arab country. Israel is trying to keep Islamic holy sites from the Palestinians. Jerusalem is Islam's third holiest city. Well, the Quran says nothing about Jerusalem. It mentions Mecca hundreds of times. It mentions Medina countless times. It never mentions Jerusalem. Muhammad never visited Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the Bible mentions Jerusalem over 800 times, and the Jews can trace their roots in Jerusalem back to the days of Abraham. Israel became a nation 2,000 years before the rise of Islam. The first Jewish temple built on the Temple Mount by Solomon was built over 1,600 years before the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount. That's enough. Has Israel learned from its past? We remember this chart in Brother Mack's class on prophecy, and that word, betak, and is Israel dwelling safely or carelessly. And it's hard to define, I agree with Brother Mack, exactly what the conditions are that would set up that situation. But I think we can see within the people in the land right now an attitude of arrogance that perhaps fits within this frame. The Winograd Commission's report was a report on the Hezbollah-Israeli war of last summer, and it was very condemning to the political organization ruling in Israel right now. In fact, when the report was reviewed, the defense minister didn't even show up to hear anything about it. Netanyahu said there is a deep feeling in the public that all governing authorities have ceased to function, that everything is infected with paralysis and hopelessness. The people want a leadership that can set a clear vision and that can operate responsibly. The majority of Israelis believe that those who failed cannot do the fixing. And he says within his comments there, he reminds Israelis that our existence is based on our strength. Where's the recognition of Yahweh? This is a missile that was jointly developed between the Israelis and the U.S., and this is the one that Putin is all upset about because they want to put it in Poland and Czechoslovakia. Comments from the Deputy Director of Israeli Missile Defense Organization. The Arrow can deal with the future threats. Where's their confidence? Where's their confidence? Are they dwelling in their shame and don't know it? I think that Israelis can sleep soundly. Where is their trust? Where is deity? Foreign Minister Livni, in speaking of the Jewish Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, says that it shapes their national identity. First, that Israel, with Jerusalem as its heart, is the national homeland of the Jewish people, their refuge from persecution, their first and last line of defense. The second, that Israel is a democracy, that the values of justice, peace, and humanity first expressed by the prophets. Did the prophets talk about democracy? Are an integral part of our nation's sense and mission. Again, where is God? The Bible history of Israel does not end with the return of a part of the nation to their homeland and the establishment of a state of Israel. Divine prophecy projects the story of Israel into the future. God's covenant with Abraham promised a specific land to a specific people forever. Abraham's unshakable faith that Yahweh would, in his own defined time frame, keep his promises. That same faith is not shared by many of his natural descendants. The few who have retained that faith in whatever age are called the remnant. And Isaiah tells us in Isaiah 10, in that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean upon him that smote them, but will lean upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. Destruction is decreed, overflowing with righteousness. For Adonai Yahweh Tzvaoth will make a full end, as decreed, in the midst of all the earth. Therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh Tzvaoth, O my people who dwell in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian when they smite with the rod and lift up their staff against you as the Egyptian did. For in a very little while my indignation will come to an end, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. Our thoughts, and the thoughts that should be on the lips of all of us, is as Paul wrote in Romans, Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. Let's enter into our memorial service with the singing of hymn number 155. Bread of heaven, on thee we feed, for thy flesh is meat indeed. Hymn number 155. Ecclesia's basis of fellowship is exclusively the unamended statement of faith, and we welcome those who believe and adhere to those doctrines and commandments stated therein. In Luke 22, we read, Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. What did this feast mean to Jesus? I don't believe we can possibly imagine how important it was to him. He had celebrated this feast many times before, but now his own death would be ushered in as the antitypical Paschal lamb. The feast was a sign of great deliverance in the past, first from the angel of death, and from the oppression of Egypt. That first Passover, so many hundreds of years earlier, was eaten in haste and has been a means of deliverance. We're all familiar with the things related to it. It was to save a special people, the Israelites. Any stranger who wished to keep it must meet certain criteria, as we read in Exodus 12. And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, "This is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof, but every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A foreigner and an hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall you break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it, and when a stranger shall sojourn with thee, and will keep the Passover of the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it, and he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is home-born, and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you." Being delivered that night was contingent upon carrying out certain instructions. It was necessary to slay the lamb in the manner described. Its blood was to be put in a vessel, and hyssop was taken and dipped into the blood. The doorpost and the lintel was then struck with the hyssop. God told the children of Israel that when the angel of death saw the blood, that he would overpass the house and not enter to destroy the firstborn. Obviously, an angel can distinguish between an Israelitish family and an Egyptian one. There is a principle in this arrangement that God will not save apart from a demonstration of faith and obedience on the part of those who are saved. Hebrews tells us that Moses, through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyeth the firstborn should touch them. Jesus knew all this. He knew that these events were a great shadow of things to come, a shadow of something divinely designed. He knew that he was the substance of the shadow, the true Paschal Lamb about to be slain to deliver his people. With these thoughts going through his mind, we can better appreciate his words to his disciples. "With desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say unto you, I will not any more eat thereof until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God." We are now in the act of partaking of the antitypical Passover. We became Israelites when we were baptized into Christ. We are no longer aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. We now partake of the Paschal Lamb, not the literal body of Christ, but assimilating his doctrine. We partake of the unleavened bread, mentally feeding on the commandments of Christ, and strive to put them in practice in all sincerity and truth. When the blood was sprinkled on the houses, they were given this command, "And none of you shall go out at the door of the house until the morning." The house sprinkled with blood was a type of Christ. We, like Israel, are safe in our antitypical blood-sprinkled house, Jesus the Christ. We will be in great danger if we wander away before the ushering in of that great day of deliverance. It came to pass in Egypt that at midnight, the firstborn of Pharaoh, the firstborn of the captives that was in prison, the firstborn of cattle were all smitten. We are still in the evening of our antitypical Passover, partaking of the lamb, the bitter herbs, and the unleavened bread. The actual passing over is yet to occur. This will be fulfilled when we are delivered into the kingdom. At midnight of that memorable event in Egypt, a cry went up from the Egyptians. In the time of the antitypical deliverance of all the kindreds of the earth, there shall be great wailing because of him. Until that time, Christ has bidden us to connect these events. The slaying of the antitypical lamb and the deliverance of his people by the simple ceremony of the breaking of bread and drinking wine. Christ is now a deliverer on the basis of his own shed blood. Our deliverance will take place on the same principle of faith and obedience. In obeying his command to observe this memorial, we show our faith and obedience. If we neglect it, we show that we are lacking in both. As Paul admonishes the Corinthians, let us examine ourselves, and so let us eat of this bread and drink of this wine, showing the Lord's death till he come. Let's turn to the account in Matthew 26. Matthew 26, starting at verse 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Brother James Moabeer.